Naomi was a 27-year-old Wiradjuri woman who was 6 months pregnant when she died. In the lead-up to her death, she'd presented 18 times to Tumut Hospital. She was never referred to a specialist, but from time to time, she was referred to drug and alcohol services. Those services reported back to the hospital that Naomi did not have a drug and alcohol problem, and yet even after her mother complained about her being referred to drug and alcohol services, they continued to do so. On the day that she passed away, she presented at just past midnight on New Year's Eve. The two nurses that saw her gave her a Panadol, two Panadols, and sent her home. She had meningococcal virus and she was in the process of dying. And in the morning when she woke up, I think she'd given up on that hospital, and instead of re-presenting because of her deteriorating condition, she stayed home and passed away. She leaves behind a family in grief and mourning, a partner that was looking forward to marriage and a child, and lives in tatters. And to a very large extent, the family and the community say that racial prejudice played a part in her death.
Chelsea, I'm just going to ask you, as an Aboriginal woman, when you hear the circumstances of Naomi's death, how do you respond to that? And what sort of signals do you think it sends to Aboriginal women?
Look, I think it's kind of mixed emotions. You can't help not but be angry about the injustice of what happened to Naomi and her family and everyone that's affected by this. But at the same time, I think for a lot of Aboriginal women, and I think that's it, I think we look at the racialised and gendered nature of this, it's not uncommon to be turned away from health services. It's not uncommon to not be believed, not be trusted, and particularly the Aboriginal mother. If we think about the way in which the Aboriginal mother is imagined in the, you know, the public imagining of the Aboriginal mother, we all know what that is. And I know for myself, even working in the health system, but being a client of its supposed care, the way in which I have been read at various points of entry through the healthcare system as a mother of five children living in a poor neighbourhood. I know exactly how my body's being read. I know exactly how my parenting capabilities are read. I know exactly how my intelligence is read. And I often have to bring with me an advocate and work hard to advocate for myself during the course of my own illness in order to get proper care. So I think for black fellas, more broadly, appealing to the healthcare system to care is an all too common experience. Hence my interest in looking at the ways in which racism operates in the health system to produce the health inequalities that we experience. We die earlier. That's a product of the society in which we live in. It's not because we don't know any better. So I think it speaks to a broader issue around healthcare access and the fact that healthcare for Indigenous peoples, I think few people realise that it's still new for Indigenous people to have care within the healthcare system. So 1989... I was 10 years old, and that was the first time this country had a national Aboriginal health strategy. They didn't implement it, but it was the first articulation of a national strategy. And up until that point, there was this fairly confident claim that we were a dying race. It was almost the nation's been comforted by our departure, our demise, our death.
I'm going to come back to your work more deeply, but I just also want to talk to Anita and, again, just your very personal reaction when you hear the story.
I guess, being a nurse and having worked in the area of health education and cultural competence, I was not surprised, unfortunately. I've met many nurses and many doctors in the health setting for a very long time who are racially profile us. And Naomi's story is very disturbing, and there are so many really big issues that I think the system failed Naomi on so many levels. And the people can still create this ideology of deficit within our community as a reason and purpose for treating us poorly is really, it's negligence. And I think it's clinical negligence, and I really think we should call it for what it is in relation to, you know, we need to voice and create terminology around this space so that we are really dealing with issues. And I guess my concern is hearing the voices of people who say making a complaint doesn't make a difference. We just don't trust the system to provide any opportunity for making a difference to our health outcomes. And that's a voice I heard yesterday from our people who are working in the health settings, who are continuing to deal with, you know, deaths because of this racial profiling. And we need to really make a difference in this space. And I'm just so thrilled that you're doing this case.
So I might just then follow up on that in terms of what you think the learnings should be from this case. You talk about the need for change.
Yeah.
What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think currently New South Wales Health runs a program called Respecting the Difference. And it's an online cultural module, which a lot of people, when they take it, think that it's fabulous, and maybe it is, but I'm the cultural competence queen for a while. Think, you know, there's no point doing online module stuff. You need to be sitting down, talking to people and building that knowledge. Health services, I guess we really do need to unpack the system and appreciate that local health districts have a responsibility to provide culturally safe care. And they're meant to be doing that in partnership with community-controlled health organisations, and that we have to unpack that system. And the system has gotten away with not being unpacked because they continue to profile as, oh, we really cared, we really did the right thing, it was our mistake, or it wasn't our mistake, and the blame continuously goes onto the family. I think we really do need to analyse that cultural competence is a systemic thing, and the institutional racism that continues to reverberate in our health services, not just our health services, in our universities. We are still teaching people to be biased around First Nation people in this health setting. So it goes beyond just that space and maybe that country town you're living in. It's surrounded in everything that we do. But unfortunately, we have seen this happen time after time after time after time after time, and go, well, how do we make it change? Justice is not in our court.
Chelsea, I wonder if we can bring you in now just to maybe reflect on, obviously through your work as a researcher and a practitioner, what are the sorts of things that you would hope would be highlighted by this case and would change?
Yeah, look, I think I've trained as an Aboriginal health worker and I did the hospital liaison role for a long time, and back in the day we used to have to do cultural awareness training for health professionals to teach them how to treat us better via our culture. And I'm really over appealing to the health system to treat us nicer via our cultural practices. I'm interested in what we do and how cases like this, how we can use them to compel the state to change. The unfortunate thing about this is that often we look to the coronial inquiries as, and for mob too, as a sense of justice, that we might find justice there, but they're not designed for that purpose. And so for me, I'm interested in what do we do now to compel the state to do what it's supposed to do for us. Not appealing to the state, but compelling. And so there needs to be, for my mind, the intellectual work around critical race and the health system. And there also needs to be the legal work around taking cases and holding the state accountable for the deaths of black people that were preventable and avoidable and should never have happened. So I'm interested in how we do that work and how we work together around that, because it's the only way it's going to change. And, you know, we've seen that overseas. We know in lots of ways that that's the only way it's going to change. What we're finding, just even a cursory look at coronial inquiries, the publicly available ones, when we compare Indigenous deaths in the health system and non-Indigenous people who are dying in the health system, the coronial inquiries, to me, read as a kind of washing clean the consciousness of the health system, or the conscious of the state. So make me think about Henry Reynolds. There's a quote where he says, racism is as functional for the settler as the cult revolver. One clears the land, the other clears the conscience. Now, the health system does its job, and the coronial inquiries do their job, and both are founded on racism throughout all of the ways in which it operates. What we need to do, is, for me as an Indigenous scholar, is to reveal how. So then we could do something about it. I think that this is a really important case, but there are many more that we need to look at to show the pattern of behaviour in order to compel the state to change.
I think there's also a number of mechanisms we need to adopt and take up. And I think the Health Complaints Department of Health Services is vital. I think we need to utilise that space. We also need to make them be very clear about what is something that we can complain about. And we also need a mechanism within our community controlled health services around chasing up complaints. Seriously, with Miss Williams's story, her mother did make an official complaint. And still, yes, in writing. And she was still, her complaint was not taken up any further. And I think that was, for me, the mechanism that I saw that we need to, if we haven't had a complaint responded to within a week, we go straight to the minister. And I think the minister will get very sick of our complaints. And that's how we're going to make a shift in the system. We systemically do need to create some change in that space. And I think we use our power, and particularly supported by our organisations, then I've suggested that we actually have a person in a health setting that takes that process up so that we do not have what happened to Naomi.
I want to just add to that. I think there's a lot of work going on in this space at the moment and a lot of discussion going on amongst Indigenous organisations, and National Justice Project also involved in that. I think it comes, the solution is through a number of different pathways, the two that you've raised, but also setting standards and policies that include not just cultural competency, but cultural safety, and making it a professional standard. So nurses and midwives at the moment actually have a requirement to provide culturally safe care. That gives us, lawyers and family members, an opportunity to hold those nurses accountable. We were looking at this recently in relation to nurses at Banksia Hill Youth Detention Centre. The Aboriginal children there were asking for a caseworker to go with them to see the nurses because they were complaining that the nurses were bullying them and being uncaring. Those nurses refused to allow a caseworker to visit with the child. We have the opportunity now to make a complaint about those nurses because they're not providing culturally safe care. So what's important there is there's a standard, it's a professional standard that we can hold them to, and we have a pathway for some accountability. Now, the other thing that I've been thinking of also through this process is there's a lack of collection of data. You cannot find, for example, anywhere the differences in delay times in emergency from arrival to seeing a medical practitioner by race. And I can tell you what we do keep punishes the victim once again by saying, oh, Aboriginal people leave without discharge against medical advice. We keep that statistic, but what we don't keep is how long they've been waiting before they got to actually see someone and how long they have to wait to get the lift home. There's a million reasons why they may have to leave, but the system blames them. So it's accountability, but it's also collecting statistics so we can maintain that accountability.
Chelsea, did you have a comment about that?
I think just to cultural safety, like I'm a strong proponent of culturally safe care. A lot of these cases, though, is just a refusal to provide care.
And
what I found in having to teach cultural awareness all over the years, in Canada, and even in higher ed, you teach Indigenous health, you have all of these, you know, students of the health sciences complaining about the special treatment that blackfellas get. So in response to that, they refuse to give proper treatment to us. So sometimes cultural safety and framing it within the space of cultural safety, for a lot of non-Indigenous people, for them it represents another special thing that Indigenous people get that they resent us for and therefore won't even examine us. Part of me thinks, let's just talk about clinical care. Because a lot of these cases are about the refusal to just assess someone when they present repeatedly and assess properly. So that's the danger of cultural safety, situating it with the cultural safety discourse.
And I don't have all the solutions, and I'm interested in debating this with you because we're all looking for a solution. But if you don't try and understand the cultural difference between yourself and the patient, you might not be able to elicit a history. So in
oh, I know that. I'm not saying I'm against cultural safety and that we teach it. But what I'm saying in terms of preventable and avoidable deaths, a lot of these cases have nothing to do with our ancient cultural practices that inhibited their ability to assess us properly. They just didn't provide appropriate care as they should as clinicians. And I want to send cases and hold health professionals accountable for refusing to provide proper care in the first instance. So in terms of the battleground that we have, I think there's cultural safety is a solution to how do we remedy and improve. Right. But in terms of the immediate drawing attention to what's happening, this is, I mean, the case of Naomi, it's not because of her cultural otherness.
Patty, I just want to, before we get back into Naomi Williams's case and particularly some of the historical context in which it should be viewed, I'm very aware of the work that you've done in hospitals, and we've already had quite a discussion about cultural competence and the way that hospital staff respond to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people within the system. You work very much in the area of child protection and specifically with assisting families, Aboriginal families, to challenge DOCS orders of removal. I just wanted to get your perceptions, because some of that work takes place in hospitals, and I wondered if you could give us a bit of a reflection on what you see in the work that you're doing in terms of this issue of competency within the hospital system.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Larissa. Yeah, I think that, I mean, a lot of it's building on what's already been said. I mean, I think you can sort of see two continuities with the colonial history of Australia in the present in terms of the treatment of Aboriginal people in the health system. I mean, Chelsea's already articulated some of it very clearly. You know, on the one hand, there's the exclusion, just the straight-out racist exclusion that was a formalised segregation through the health system for most of Australian history and continues. The other element of it is the extent to which the health system has been integrated into the apparatus of protection and oppression, and, you know, and is a mechanism through which Aboriginal people have been controlled by the state. And, you know, I mean, I'm doing a history PhD looking at the 1930s, and Cecil Cook, the chief protector in the Northern Territory, was also the chief medical officer, and those two systems worked hand in hand. So, you know, what I see is a real fear of the hospital system from Aboriginal women, Aboriginal expectant mothers in particular, because reports go in, their babies get taken from the hospital, and just some horrific cases. Like, you know, actually was working with one family where the mother left the hospital immediately after a cesarean to go down to the children's court to try and defend herself against a removal order, and won the case. The judge said this child isn't to be removed, left the court, called the hospital, and they said, oh, facts have just come and taken your baby. Right, they took the baby and then bunged on an appeal to the Supreme Court that night to try and justify the removal against the president, actually, of the Children's Court here in Sydney. You know, and the money that was sitting in that room, we had about, you know, 20 grand of silks there, etc., to try and prosecute this case to remove this child. And this is a system which says that, you know, impoverished Aboriginal women are negligent to their children. So, I mean, there's, you know, other cases we could go into, but that's, you know, very, very much part of the experience. People don't go to hospital, you know, because of, you know, the fear that they have. And then when they do go, you know, they often treated in these appalling ways.
George, can you maybe just talk a little bit to the context of Naomi Williams's case and the history of Tumut Hospital? Because there are some interesting historical aspects to this case.
I think that's one of the most tragic features of this case, the connection of the family to the hospital and the history of racial segregation at that hospital. Naomi's grandmother had to learn to become a midwife to enable Aboriginal women to give birth outside the hospital because it was segregated until the 60s. Her grandmother had also worked within the hospital and built up relationships with the nurses, some of whom were there to the time that Naomi died and continuing. And when her mother wrote for help, pleading for help for her daughter, those pleas were ignored. And that's the tragedy when I see Naomi's mother, and she trusted the system. She believed in the system. She believed that if she wrote and asked for her daughter to be treated as an equal, that she would be, and that didn't happen.
Chelsea, when you understand that aspect or hear that aspect of the story, which is in some ways, as George says, adds to the tragedy, but it's not really exceptional that Aboriginal families would have that history with the medical system. What are your reflections in terms of what you see today in that historical context?
So I guess I think Fadi's point in this, you know, I always teach health science students today about health as an apparatus of colonial control. And so, yes, I teach about cultural safety, but I don't think the state has been held accountable for what it has done and continues to do, hence why I'm interested in how do we hold it accountable in a more tangible way rather than just getting first-year health science students to reflect on their whiteness. That's part of the journey, but that's not the whole solution to this, to prevent our mob from dying. But I think about, you know, Fanon talks about in the medical science being imposed by the occupying power in the colonial situation, going to see the doctor, the mayor, the constable, the administrator, they're identical moves. And we see that play out in every one of these deaths. So it's like, we know this, so what do we do about making a difference? And the only way is, for me, I've just got to the point where the only way is we have to make them pay. Because when they're made to pay, they then change. They hold themselves accountable. Close the gap has not served us well. What it has meant is the health system rewards itself financially by surveilling black bodies even more so. And we get a T-shirt for the experience.
Did you have any final comments, Juanita, on this case?
I guess, well, yeah, I guess there's loads there. Yeah. I totally think the mother of Naomi did believe that she was going to get equitable care. And yes, health is still an apparatus of colonisation, and I think we really need to recognise the determinants of racism and colonisation in this story. They're critical to the way this poor young woman was managed. And you were right. For me, the lack of clinical care and lack of referral is just, I mean, that should be something that's highly considered to be negligence. And I think we need to really utilise this case as not unlike Gurumul's case, where people have been really treated poorly, and this is how we shift that space. We also need to empower our people around this is not okay and we can actually make a difference in this space. And I really would like to see that that's how we utilise this case.